Tonight on The Mindset, we have a special show for you. We have one of our followers of The Mindset. His name is Walter Vattenweiler, and he's going to be our special guest here on The Mindset, right here on the Speaking the Heart Radio Network. Hit it, AW. Hey everybody, it is Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and that means it's time for The Mindset, where we do our best in order to show you that your mindset can be your very best ally instead of your own personal enemy. Tonight we have a very special show. We have one of our followers of The Mindset be with us. His name is Walter Vattenweiler, and we asked him to be our special guest, so let's get started.
Really, Walter, it's as simple as can be. We're just going to have a chat. You know what I mean? It's like a weekend chat together. You have a lot in common with what it is that the show is all about as far as being able to provide people with awareness to certain aspects of mental health that can be helpful for them to live a life outside of what it is that they're challenged by. And it also brings awareness to those who are supporters of or those who know nothing about what it is that a lot of us go through. You deal with borderline personality disorder, as I do, PTSD. You're very familiar with the different aspects of DBT and CBT. So we think that you're a great aspect to the show. It's our special guest here. And also, Claudia, he's a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, actually, I'm most probably more Buddhist than a specialist of CBT, DBT, borderline, or PTSD, but yes.
Yeah, what it is that you live the others, but you specialize in the one.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Well, the thing I find very interesting about Buddhism is that actually I don't consider that Buddhism is a religion, definitely not. It is a spirituality, but it's before anything a toolkit for healing from trauma, wounds, and other difficulties that we struggle with. So that's what is interesting for me with meditation, with and especially with inner meditation or inside meditation, sorry.
Right.
Well, okay. And I agree with that 100%. Buddhism really is not a religion. It is a spiritual path, a spiritual walk through life. And that's one of the reasons I'm very fond of it also, is there's no dogma there, as, you know, there can be with other organized religions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So, Walter, where are you from?
I was born in Geneva. So I'm 43 years old. I was born in Geneva in 1972, in the cantonal hospital of Geneva. And I grew up for the first 24 years of my life in Meran, which is a small suburb next to Geneva. My parents are a bit of a complex background. My mother is left Budapest in 56 when there was a student revolution. And she came to Switzerland, to Basel first and then to Geneva. And my father was born in Budapest and they left the country just after World War II. He came first to Zurich with his Swiss father and Hungarian stepmother. And then he moved to Geneva for work. And then, funnily enough, the two Hungarians met at work in Geneva.
Oh, that's weird. Yeah. Now, Claudia is from Germany. So, Claudia, why don't you give us a background of where it is that you're from and how it is that you came over to the United States?
My parents were both born in Hamburg. And my mother was so completely in love with the United States that she rather insisted to my father that we needed to move here. So in 1969, we emigrated here. My father ended up going back to trade school to learn how to work with microscopes and cameras so that he had a position that he could come to here. So he went to go work for the company Leica in New Jersey. And actually, true story, they promised him kind of the world. And once he got here, they reneged on pretty much everything and basically said, well, you don't speak the language, so we're not going to give you the salary that we promised, and you're kind of stuck. So my dad went to night school and learned English, told Leica to do terrible things with their job, and then he started his own company.
Wow, that's pretty inspiring in itself. Okay, so Walter, you also were into the business realm of things, but it was after you had some experiences in your life that kind of, it didn't defy you, but it definitely directed you in the way that you wanted to go, which was the business sector. So what were some of those things that had happened that got you into that business mindset?
That is a good question. Actually, what I was dreaming about when I was pre-adolescent was to be a robotician. So that's what I wanted to do.
Okay.
The goal of that was actually, I thought that working for human beings is a little bit of a stupid thing to do, especially, well, manual jobs and things that can be automated. So I wanted to be the guy that automates the world.
Okay.
It didn't go in that direction because actually my first job was to work for software engineering in bank and finance, which is as far as possible from helping human beings as it can be.
Mm-hmm.
But over the course of the last, most probably the last, 10 years, but especially in the last 2 years, I realized that I was not living my dream in terms of work, but I was living the dream of my father. So you asked me what happened to me before that. Well, as I told you, my mother and my father met in 62 in Geneva at work. They spent 10 years together. So with my mother being a very sensitive person, most probably having schizophrenia, I'm not sure, but from the medication she was taking, she had schizophrenia. Or she actually developed it after my birth, most probably as a psychotic postpartum.
Okay.
And my father is a fairly stiff and wounded person also because of his family history. He's lost his mother when he was 4 or 5 from sickness, and he had a stepmother that never fully accepted him, spent her time criticizing him and diminishing him. So these two people came together, helped each other, and made a child. Well, actually, she decided to make a child. My father didn't want. And my mother, after I was born, became increasingly deeply depressed first, then increasingly irrational with hallucination voices. So that was late in the process. But my childhood from 0 to 9 was basically a very sensitive mother that was extremely sad and extremely feeling extremely bad, and a very stubborn father that was trying to direct her life for her own good, but without the necessary emotional skills to really understand what was going on in her mind.
Mm-hmm.
And progressively, my mother degraded and went to mental hospital, came out, decided on her own to stop her medication until she committed suicide when I was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She committed suicide by first hitting me with a chair so that I don't see what's going on and jumping out of the window of my room.
Oh. So sorry.
So that happens. But actually, if I look at my background, this event is a hard one, obviously, for a child, but it's mostly the way it was processed both by myself and by my father and by the psychologist that tried to help me that was not fully appropriate, because basically, the next day morning, I was in hospital with a broken hand and some stitches on my skull. And my father came and told me, oh, your mother's heart was too weak, she died. And a week later, he told me, oh, actually, her heart was not too weak, but she went because she decided to go. And that was the end of the explanation of why she decided to go. So based on a fairly emotionally disturbed past 9 years and this event, I developed in myself thoughts like she was adoring me. It was obvious, but she decided to leave me. So why? Does it mean that people that love you will always run away?
Mm.
What does it mean in terms of self-worth? Who am I in these things? And these things were not exactly processed as a proper grieving and something that I could bring to the front of my thoughts, work through, and get at rest with, but they were processed in the background, while in the foreground I was a nice kid, good at school, seemingly happy and strong, while my mind was slowly rotting away in the background. This went fairly unnoticed until I was 20 years old.
Wow.
And met my first girlfriend. And, well, now, looking at it from my 43 years old, this first girlfriend was, I mean, she's a nice person, but she was not the one or whatever. But I thought that because this person is interested in me, it must mean that it's true love.
And when she done... Hang on for 1 second, yes? Walter. Claudia, I want to bring Claudia into this as well.
Yeah.
Claudia, that's a pretty tumultuous story. It's one that unfortunately isn't uncommon. And let me ask you a question. The way Walter explained, the way that he was told that his mom had passed away, it certainly made it so that it was kind of something that was even almost normal in a day, or almost like it was expected. Is that something that's common, is when somebody has somebody pass away like that, in a way like that? Is it common for them to kind of shut off and find themselves directing themselves into one aspect of life as opposed to the entire life?
I'm not exactly sure I understand the question, Shane.
Okay. So, like, for instance, it appears from Walter's account of what happened, he was told that his mom had passed away, which was very abrupt.
Yes.
The way that he was told was very abrupt.
Yes.
And the way that he went on from that day forward seemed to be kind of directed into school and kind of into a way of, well, this happens. In fact, when we had said, I'm so very sorry, Walter had said, well, this happens. So is that common as far as like somebody who goes through a traumatic situation like that when people find themselves in that type of situation?
I think that kids especially feel that their upbringing is normal. We
yeah.
all do.
Right.
So whatever happens to us is that's what happens. We don't really understand that maybe our experience in childhood is not the norm
right.
until we kind of enter mainstream kind of society when we leave our family of origin to go find our own path. So even if you grew up in an alcoholic family, you would just think it's normal.
Right.
If you grew up in a domestic violence situation, you would just think it's normal. Walter's story, of course, is, the tragedy, Walter, I really am sorry, is significant. The impact that suicide has on people is significant. And certainly the message being, well, people will love you, but then they'll leave. That's a strong core belief that stays in your brain. If we look at cognitive behavior therapy, you know, there was no filter that you could have as a kid to say, wow, I shouldn't believe that because that's not the ultimate truth. You don't get that growing up. It becomes the belief that you carry with you through life, and that influences you. You know, Walter, you said that your first girlfriend, you felt great because here was somebody who loved you. So you thought it was true love.
Mm-hmm.
So that's yeah. kind of, you know, where the brain kind of goes with that. And then the question is, was that first girlfriend, well, because you said first girlfriend, obviously there were subsequent ones,
mm-hmm.
you know, was that relationship unhealthy? Why didn't it work? Because, you know, now your brain is looking for a pattern of somebody, you know, a certain type of woman, and not consciously, that is going to kind of fulfill that core belief of people can love you, but they leave.
Well, the relationship was good for the first 3 months, and it lasted, well, on and off for 10 years. And in my mind for 20, that is the part that is not healthy. The problem is it was great for the first 3 months because it's a discovery of two sensitive and intelligent and quite compatible people. But the circumstances that were around it and actually the core values that we had were not compatible. So it was not the right person because it would have never worked out properly. But my problem with that was it was the first one that showed me interest or that I realized was showing me interest. Mm-hmm. And this fact that she was showing me interest made a so deep imprint that she must be the one that I never gave up. I never gave up despite having four subsequent girlfriends and two of them who became my wives. Wow. So it still was the impression that she could be the only one that is because she's the first one that showed me this level of attention that I was craving for. That's the problem. That's the problem.
I can identify a lot with what it is that you're saying, Walter, because I didn't have as traumatic of a situation that you had described. As a second grader, my second grade teacher abused me in front of the class, you know, as to where what they did is they went ahead and they would yell at me. They would pull my hair. They would slap me in the back of the head. And they would tip my desk over. I remember quite vividly, to where all my books would come out on the floor and in front of everybody. The thing is, though, for whatever reason, throughout my childhood, I dealt with self-loathing. So for me, I wasn't okay with it, but it wasn't something that really surprised me because I didn't have a whole good feeling about myself. And then next thing you know, somebody isn't having a good feeling about me. So it kind of fit. It was what it was. Like you had mentioned, you know, these things happen. It wasn't until one of my classmates had told their parents and then their parents told my parents what was going on. And my parents came to me and they said, "Is this really happening?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And they looked at me and are like, "What do you mean? Well, yeah." As if like this wasn't a normal thing, but it was something that was normal to me. So I can definitely identify with what you're saying in a smaller sense from what it is that you had gone through. And then when it comes to the relationship thing, and Claudia, you might want to come in here as well. I had dealt with extreme codependency, or I still deal with extreme codependency, because for whatever reason, I was not able to communicate to people to be able to help me get through what it is that I was going through as a young child. And so I developed this codependency disorder to where the whole aspect of codependency is that there's somebody who's leaning on somebody or needing somebody all the time. And then the opposite of that is somebody who's rescuing somebody all the time. And so I was doing that to be able to help others in order to kind of satisfy what it is that I wasn't able to get. Claudia, does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Certainly, as we grow older, again, the messages that we get and how we're raised influence us heavily in how we choose relationships when we become adults, because we are reenacting our childhood or trying to heal our childhood. That's very important for us. Well, for the brain. And the bottom line is it creates unhealthy situations. So whether it's codependency or, you know, being kind of like a victim in your life, and not just necessarily in an intimate relationship, but just in all relationships. Because when we're codependent, we're not just codependent with our intimate partner. We can be codependent with all the people in our life. So it's very important that we do recognize the messages that we received when we were growing up. And then to be able to say, well, those were unhealthy people that gave me those messages. Yeah. So therefore, those messages must be unhealthy, which means it's okay to reject them.
Hey everyone, this is Shane Schultz of the Speaking of Heart Radio Network. Join us for Voices for Change at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, where our good friends, the Lombardo family, that's Rebecca and Joe, they provide a healing platform through awareness and a voice for change. This week's episode, they're going to be interviewing the author of Black Sails and White Rabbits, that's Kevin A. Hall. He's an Olympian and a cancer survivor and much, much more. So join us this Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, right here on the Speaking of the Heart Radio Network.
Okay.
Actually, jumping on that, what I meant when I said it's okay because it's just circumstances and life, I still mean that absolutely today. Mm-hmm. Because the problem of my childhood trauma is not the trauma itself. I mean, this is nothing. I mean, everyone did his best or her best, mm-hmm. and it failed and it went very wrong. The problem is not what happened. The problem is how I processed it and how I was helped to process it or not helped. Because the same circumstances with a proper processing would have led to a different next 30 years or whatever. So I still mean I am not sorry for myself for what happened. Mm-hmm. I am sorry that the things did not, that I didn't get more help in a more structured way and in a more effective way at that time. Actually, the reason I created the blog I'm creating is because I find it helpful if people realize that they are traumatized before they reach age 43. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to what I try to bring through in my blog post that I'm doing now is no, it's not normal to be abused. No, it's not normal to be abandoned. No, it's not normal to be neglected, but it's also not your fault. But once you realize that you are a victim of one of these three childhood traumas, it is something that can be helped, improved, fixed, and you can move on. And the earlier you realize that, the less years you spend living in an illusion of wrong attachments or wrong dreams, goals, or whatever. That's my point. So I'm still not sorry for what happened. I'm sorry that I couldn't process it better.
Well, and I can totally see that perspective. And I agree with you, Walter. You know, what happens to us. And that's not something that we invited into our lives. It's not something we wished for. Certainly finding out sooner rather than later that you were traumatized or that this was not the norm and that there's help out there for you to process through it in a healthy way is extremely important, which is why you being understanding DBT and CBT, I honestly believe that that should be taught in high school so that, you know, people have those skills going into the world.
My opinion is even deeper than that. I think that we should teach mindfulness to kids as early as possible.
That yes, I agree with that totally.
And not the spiritual aspect of Buddhism, but really the technical aspect of meditation and how it allows to face reality as it is, both the internal and outer, the inner and outer reality. This is something we are very ill equipped with. I don't know how the education system is in the States, but in Switzerland, the whole goal of education is to make efficient little workers for the economy and absolutely not healthy, grown-up people that are flexible and adaptable to the environment. And so mindfulness would be a good thing. Assertive communication would be a good thing to teach very early, which, if yeah. I remember well, actually both are part of DBT also.
Yeah.
I completely agree. I think the sooner we teach these skills, especially, like you said, the mindfulness practice, not necessarily the spiritual aspect of it, but the actual techniques and to practice uh-huh. that day. I mean, you know, there are countries, America is not one of them. We are not enlightened in our education system really at all, in my opinion. I mean, in the German system, school is much more suited toward the individual so that you're not kind of pushed into one mold, which is what America certainly does.
Does the same in Switzerland.
Pardon?
It's the same in Switzerland. Switzerland is one of the most neoliberal country in Europe. I would sometimes be tempted to say it's the last neoliberal country in Europe. So Switzerland, the goal of Swiss education is to make nice little soldiers for the economy. Which I don't think is the goal of life.
That's where you develop your Buddhism spirituality as well, I imagine, for both of you, right?
Well, For myself, the Buddhism thing is a weird double encounter, actually. Around the age of, I don't know, between 18 and 22, I don't remember exactly, I stumbled on a Zen koan, which is the story of the tiger and the raspberry, if you know that story.
I do not.
It's a man that is running from a tiger. Okay. And he's very tired because he's running since some time, and he reaches the edge of a cliff, and he looks down. It is a very high cliff, so the things start not looking too well, but he spots a branch that is sticking out of the cliff. He jumps down, he hangs himself on the branch, and what he realizes that hanging on one hand with a tiger looking at him quite hungry is not something that will ensure him a long-lasting life. Uh-huh. At the same time, he realizes that he spots a raspberry bush a little bit away. He picks up the raspberry, tastes it, and it tastes wonderful. So that is the Zen story in question. And reading that story, I had shivers in my back, in my arms, and everywhere, not understanding why, actually. And I still don't fully understand why it did that deep impact. Well, the background of this story is that in every moment of your life or in the present moment, you can always enjoy the things despite all the circumstances that are not that nice. That's the essence of this story. But it made a very deep emotional impact on me for a reason that I still don't understand fully. So I started reading more and more of Zen Buddhism especially, and I started practicing Zen meditation. And then I stopped practicing Zen meditation because for two reasons. First one, Zen meditation is the least directive form of meditation ever. Basically, you count your breath, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then you start again at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The goal being always the same, like with all meditation technique, is to teach the brain to focus on what is and not on the stories that run in the background of our minds. Mm-hmm. So Zen meditation is not exactly what works well for me. For me, insight meditation, so Vipassana, works better because it is a little bit more, you can do a certain number of guided things in order to focus on your breath still, but also learn to watch your thoughts without interacting with them and those kind of things. So there was this technical aspect that didn't work too well for me. And there's also the other aspect, which is that I started being increasingly careerist. And I simply lost touch with myself. I entered into the goal of becoming the new Steve Jobs, to become rich, famous, and powerful. And I completely lost touch with this emotional and human part of myself for way too long. But that's why I stopped around that time. Then, I don't know, something like 2 years ago, I started after I had a first burnout in 2006 due to my careeristic running for illusional grandeur. Mm-hmm. And then I was running towards my second burnout, most probably in 2011, 2012, 2013. And I started again meditating. But this time I started meditating with something that was working better for me. And this is where I reconnected really with Buddhism. So it's not that old, mm-hmm. 2 or 3 years ago that I started that. And it's the first time that I actually made progress or actually even realized that I had something to sort in myself, that things were not perfect the way they were, and that I was not processing neither emotions nor relationships nor anger nor fear nor anything in a way that was very healthy for myself. That's what reconnected me with the Buddhist thing.
Boy, you definitely connect with both of us on that. I mean, Claudia, why don't you go ahead and tell us about your effects of your Buddhist recollections and how you got started.
Well, certainly I appreciate the story of the tiger and the raspberry. I grew up in a family where my parents were very much against organized religion, almost to the point where they were quite dogmatic about me not going to a church or choosing any kind of religion immediately as soon as I started to ask questions about it. And I started asking questions about it at a young age. I was kind of, I don't want to say obsessed, but I was very concerned about the concept of God and devil and, you know, because all my friends went to church and I heard everything that they were talking about and I got kind of worried for myself since I wasn't going to church. So I became a spiritual seeker very early on in my life. My earliest memory was at 7 years old, being completely overwhelmed with the concept of the I. Like, what made me me? How am I me? How is Claudia's consciousness consciousness? And I would overwhelm myself at a very young age with that idea. So my parents eventually did agree that I could go to church with my friends and just explore. And that was probably when I was, I would say like 14, 15. So I started going to church with all different friends. So Methodist, Catholic, and everything. And I never found any solace in any of those places. And my friends actually hated going to church. So I began to question again and became overwhelmed. Why do we go, and what is the meaning, and you know, who created this? And then in 10th grade, we had global studies as a class. And that's all about, obviously, you know, countries and cultures all over the world. And that's when I was first introduced to Eastern philosophy and spirituality. And it made sense. Like, it hit me like a ton of bricks. This is the way. This is the path. So I became an avid reader and eventually ended up discovering Native American spirituality. And it just worked so well with Buddhism that once I found, 16 years ago, I kind of discovered my tribe, I would say, where I have a meditation practice now that's very consistent. I do it in a sangha every Sunday morning, which is a group meditation with fellow seekers. And I do my own individual practice, but it just made so much sense to me. And then I found my spiritual teacher, Pema Chodron, about 16 years ago. And I actually even got to meditate with her on a retreat with 200 people. And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life to meditate with that many people. And she used the text of the Way of the Bodhisattva, which is all about the art of meditation, as our book for that retreat. It just blew me away because it is really the way that I operate in life and feel effective and feel peaceful and find myself having compassion for everyone. And it's a practice that I adore every day.
Walter, I mentioned the fact that meditation didn't really grab hold of him with the aspects that he was trying at the time. That's not uncommon as well. There's a number of different ways to meditate, and it's not uncommon that you have to go through a few in order to get the one that is actually more effective for you, is it?
Well, even the Buddha said, my way is my way. You need to find your one seat. You need to try some seats, find your one seat, and stick with it once you find the one that works for you. Uh-huh. So whether you are doing Sufi dancing, yoga, insight meditation, or Christian retreat, is not that important. What is important is to find this healthy time facing yourself in a honest way, because that's the whole goal of the thing. It's developing the honesty to look at yourself exactly the way you are, without judgment, without criticism, without self-loathing, without attempts to change what you are by manipulating your own feelings. That's the whole point of the meditative practices, is to build a space between the that is your consciousness and the whole set of stories and reactions and feelings and emotions that are unfolding. Do you agree, Claudia, actually, about what I just said about the lack of importance of what is the practice?
Absolutely. I completely agree with you, Walter. I think the most important thing is that you find a practice that speaks to you.
Supposed to find the one that works for you?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Claudia?
You know, I have a phenomenal book that I really enjoy. It's called Essential Spirituality. And it talks about how a lot of the practices have the same basic philosophies and how, you know, we're kind of all on the same page and we're all one. And I really like that. And it's the same thing with cognitive behavior therapy. If you think about it, it's all in the packaging. Right. Cognitive behavior therapy is what it is. But some people relate to it through DBT. Some people relate to it through The Secret. Some people relate to it through whatever packaging you put it through. You know, The Joy of Stress from Loretta LaRouche or any of the other motivational speakers. I mean, that's the main thing that they all talk about, is how to turn your thinking and how to take control over your thinking. And it's just packaged in a way that somebody can understand it better. And I think that's how spirituality is too. To me, I understand now much more about Christianity and Catholicism than I did when I was younger, because of the diversity of my social circle. And I can appreciate, you know, aspects of all different spiritual and religious practices. And I'm grateful to my family that I didn't grow up with one specific one, because I don't think I would have been able to experience so many of them in my life. And I actually go to different churches now because of different elements. Like there's a Pentecostal church down where I used to live, and their music and gospels and the way everybody gets to participate, it's not just a sermon by their minister or pastor. Everybody gets to what they call testify. So it's kind of an audience participation model, which I love. And the music blows me away and brings me to tears every single time. Then I love going to a Christian church called Grace Fellowship, where it's kind of like going to a rock show. I guess music is a big thing for me, but it's like going to a rock concert, and it's very inspirational, highly supportive. They have so many activities their members can get involved in that it's really great. And, you know, like when it comes to Catholicism, I have a deep, deep love for Mary. These are all things that I discovered as a spiritual seeker. And I'm grateful that people can find whatever meaningful spiritual practice they can in whatever faith that they can, because we need that as human beings. We need the fellowship of spirituality, but I think we also need to connect to something bigger than ourselves to help us.
I would say there was something about that. The more I'm looking at the spiritual dimension of things, the more amazed I am by how many organized religions completely lost touch with the basic fundamental teachings of their own religion. So the spiritual side of their own religion. I cannot understand how a pastor says things like, oh, the shooting of Orlando, that's just the will of God. It's so nice that all these people died. And that is so unacceptable. And I see a growing part where many, many religious institutions are becoming more of a political powerhouse than a real spiritual thing. That's the flip side of the fact that religions, yes, they are extremely good vehicles for spirituality, but many of them are losing that the touch with the real spirituality that they are supposed to carry. Don't know what you think, Claudia.
Yes, I definitely agree with you on that also, Walter, that, I mean, even when you identify yourself as a Christian or, you know, a good person, and then, you know, we have priests who are sexually abusing their young congregation, I have a hard time reconciling how you can claim to be this spiritual person and then abuse people. And you know, the hypocrisy is something I definitely struggle with all the time.
But on that side, there is also a thing. I mean, someone who is abusing children is most probably not someone who is very healthy in his mind. The question is, why does such a big institution like the Catholic Church, instead of facing the problems and saying, okay, we have abusers, it is our church is in touch with children, so it's normal that it's attracting the predator kind of people, predatory type of people. But why don't they face it, tackle it? And why do they try to hide the facts under the carpet? And this is where, again, a layer of the Catholic hierarchy is not about spirituality or religion. It's about power and politics. And that is the unacceptable part.
I can totally agree with that, because I was christened as a Roman Catholic. I went to a military Catholic school. I was raised Lutheran. I had a whole lot of different diversity when it came to my spirituality. And I just came to the point as to where I made my own decision. And my own decision for me personally is to believe in the basic, like you were talking about, Walter, the basic spirituality of which is love, peace, and acceptance. That's really what it is that I decided to go about, and also sacrifice, you know, when it comes to, and my higher power is Jesus. That's for me. But, you know, I do believe in also a buddy of mine who's the co-host of one of the other podcasts I do, which is Arisen Strength, and that is Wayne the Hack Hacker. He is big into the universe and believing in the spirituality of the universe and how it works. So I think it's a combination of things that are for me. I don't believe that things are happening in coincidence by any means. And I do believe that, unfortunately, the human aspect definitely makes it a lot harder than what it needs to be. So I can agree with both of you on that one.
Hey everyone, this is Shane Schultz of Arisen Strength, the motivational podcast. Join us this Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time as we talk about another one of those tough subjects. It's accountability, folks. We're going to be talking about that this Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on the Speaking of the Heart Radio Network.
Do you know a writer called Osho? or spiritual leader called Osho?
I personally do not. Do you, Claudia?
Mm.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Well, it's he's from Hindu origin, if I don't mistake. I will need to check that. And his most famous book is called Love, Freedom and Aloneness, A New Vision of Relating. And there's something about the I'm asking you whether you know him, because you mentioned sacrifice.
Mm.
And I quite agree with him that sacrifice, at least from the point of view of what Christians call sacrifice, is actually potentially dangerous, in the sense that there is a risk in the Christian teaching to say love everybody and sacrifice yourself for everybody.
Oh, totally.
Love yourself. So you preach your own suffering. Don't love yourself. Don't be compassionate to yourself. Dedicate yourself to the love of others. And Osho's way of looking at it is that in order to reach selflessness, you need to become first the most selfish person on earth.
Yes. Because
if you are yourself
not
happy, if you are self-loathing, if you are doing things in order to try to compensate for your own pains, let's say, but you don't do them in order to generate the pleasure of giving for yourself. So giving to others in order to experience the pleasure of giving and having your gift received, then you are on a very dangerous path in terms of spiritual development. Do you agree with that?
I do. I actually do. I believe in that wholeheartedly, actually. I understand what it is that you're saying. And to your point, I, like I said before, I deal with extreme codependency. And I literally have sacrificed myself for others in a way that was detrimental to me. Can totally understand with what it is that you're saying.
And how was it for others? Was your sacrifice in the mid or long term a good thing for the other people that you sacrificed for?
I'd like to think so. Let's put it this way. It was good enough at the time, but it did not have long standing because of obvious reasons, because basically I was a sick person looking to rescue another sick person. So that equation just is not going to work out well when you're not aware of what it is that's really going on. And I was totally blinded by the fact that, if somebody had paid attention to me, or if somebody had given me reason to believe that they wanted to be with me, I grabbed hold of that and I would not let that go. I would do everything that I could in order to be able to keep that relationship, whether it be a friendship, whether it be a loving relationship, or even family. I would constantly go back to the well that was obviously dry, because I was trying to save the relationship, and I felt that it was my obligation to do so in order to be able to live in a world that I thought was the way that I wanted to live in. But I became aware, especially with the word codependency, I personally was ignorant to the word of codependency. I was very dependent, or independent, I should say, throughout my life. I was able to live a life of independency. So I thought, well, I can't possibly be codependent. Well, I learned the definition of codependency, and it came to realize I was everything that was codependent as well as independent. So it definitely had opened my eyes to something that I suffered from for a very, very long time. And even to this day, I do, because it's so instinctual. I really need to do my best in order to be able to make sure that it's not tipping the scale to the point of detrimental.
Yeah, I did exactly the same like you. I spent 20 years of my life thinking I was working for myself and for my own goals, and actually working for pleasing others, whether they were giving anything back, deserving it. My end goal was to please, and the reason for pleasing was to generate love. Yes?
Yes.
Yes?
Right. Absolutely. Because I kept on going back to relationships, people used to think that I was like submissive. And I'm like, I'm not submissive to the person. I'm submissive to the relationship itself. And so I was literally doing everything that I could in order to be able to keep those things together. Claudia, that's not unusual when it comes to an extreme codependent type of lifestyle.
No, not at all. One of the things that is very important to somebody who is in a codependent lifestyle is they don't feel, as I'm sure, Shane, you can speak to, You don't feel right unless that other person's happy or in a good place.
Right.
All of your emotional well-being is resting in that other person's mood or situation or stress level. When we grow up in a dysfunctional family, and the dysfunctional family can include a spectrum of things, whether it's addiction or even, you know, having like a parent who's a narcissist or something, mm-hmm. what ends up happening is it's a real setup for the future. Especially if in your family you noticed, you know, there was one person who had like emotional control where everybody wanted to make sure that person was in a good space and in a good mood because that way the household would be cool and quiet and everything would be fine. So when we carry that with us to adulthood, where the problem with being raised in a dysfunctional family is you think your childhood and upbringing is normal and the way that you get your needs met are normal. And the way that you interact with other people is normal. And then you go out into society where a predominant part of the population did not grow up in a dysfunctional family. And they're looking and reacting to you in a way that they're like, wow, you know, what's going on here? I can't relate to this person or whatever. And then you keep getting negative messages about yourself and so on. And it just keeps moving forward in that way so that you don't feel good about your life, you don't feel good about yourself, and you don't have positive outcomes in your life because you're not doing life for yourself. You're doing it for other people solely. So you end up being an empty shell.
Yeah, yeah. That sound familiar, Walter?
Yes, it's absolutely familiar to me. And what is the most amazing part of that is that on the path I followed, I stumbled, I don't know when, a year ago or roughly like that, to on the website of an American psychologist called Peter Gerlach. He had a website, he just died earlier this year, but he had a website called Breaking the Cycle, where he basically makes a point about wounded children, so children having suffered some form of childhood trauma, replicating that in their own family and generating a new generation of wounded children, which is very interesting from our perspective. At least for mine, because my parents were both wounded children and generated a wounded child. Mm-hmm. What he suggests roughly as a model, he says that based on the three basic wounds that you can, or abuse, or no, let's say childhood traumas that you can get, which are abuse, neglect, and abandonment, you are developing a certain number of consequences for that, which are excessive fear, excessive guilt, excessive shame, trust issues, either too much or too little trust, and a reality distortion, and culminating to intimacy issues. What he says is that there is a way of solving that. Actually, I tried it and it worked very well because it's very compatible with the mindfulness approach also. Is to visualize yourself as not a consistent, coherent personality that is well oiled and working together, but as a set of fragmented elements that are generated due to this trauma. For instance, you have the little pleaser in you, which is a separate you, that suddenly jumps at the front of the stage and becomes acting completely independently if getting the proper stimulation. So, for instance, you are afraid of losing someone. You don't think a single second whether actually it would not be a good idea to lose that person, but you jump into automatic mode of saving, pleasing in order for that person to come back on board and loving you, which is absolutely wonderful for abusive personalities. So narcissists are typically very good at using these kind of traits that you have against yourself. The way he suggests to help is in a mindful setup, so in a relaxed, introspective and focused way, to start engaging in conversations with that fragment of yourself, the pleaser. So, dear pleaser, how old are you? Okay, I'm 9 because that's the first time I started pleasing. Let's give you a name. You are called Plisica, whatever. I call all my subparts with an Ika at the end because my mother was calling me Valtika when I was a child. Whatever. Long story short, you engage into a conversation with this part of yourself in order to bring to light all these behaviors that are automatic and that you don't control, and try to make them not automatic. Try to build this little gap, this little mindful distance with this part of yourself to be able to intercept his automatic reaction and stop being victim of your own part, but becoming in charge of what your brain does. It's a very interesting model. I would really suggest that you have a look if you don't know this model. I like it a lot.
Yes, no, this model of treatment is one of my favorites, Walter, actually, because, you know, like it used to be definitely the inner child concept, and now they call it intra-family. So it's not just about the one child, it's about having the whole family, which is, you know, the 9-year-old pleasing part, it's the anxious part, it's the husband part, it's the work part, it's the happy part. And, you know, one of the things when you get in tune through mindfulness to just really kind of touch in and feel those different parts and how they are, it's absolutely incredible on how you can then figure out how to self-soothe those different parts to have them kind of cooperate and play nicely with each other.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So Shane, if you are still struggling with the part of wanting to be a pleaser, I would really recommend that you try that. For me, it worked extremely well.
I definitely will look into it for sure.
I almost did a bad joke. You can't imagine how many people I got rid of since I started.
No, but that's part of healing, isn't it?
It is.
Part of healing is getting rid of the people that are not healthy for you. And so yes, that's the beginning. Listen, we could talk about this for hours upon hours, I believe. I can't tell you how impressed I am to have you with us, Walter, because you definitely were a nice shot in the arm as far as the show.
Thanks a lot.
I believe that, you know, that you really bring a different aspect of it. Let's go ahead and tell people where they can find your blog and where they can find you, whether it be through the different social media aspects that you involve yourself with.
Okay, so my blog is healing.ly, L-Y. Mm-hmm. So it's healingly, but written healing.ly. And you can find at the top of the website all the social media links I have, which are basically Twitter, Pinterest, Facebook, Instagram.
Yeah.
Google Plus and LinkedIn. Not important, but I'm mostly active on Facebook and Twitter. I try to post every week or every 2 weeks a blog post on various topics, which range from, explaining what happened to me and why I think it's good that people ask themselves whether they are traumatized, whether they are grown-up wounded children, but also about stuff about simply life. So I have a blog post about why I support Bernie Sanders, which is a little bit too late now, but anyway, blog posts about Buddhism. I have blog posts about meditation. I have blog posts about anxiety and other things. All are based on my own experience. I'm not advocating anything to anyone. I'm just trying to share what happened to me and why I think that the earlier you tackle your issues, the things that make you feel bad, the things that prevent you from being happy, the earlier you get into the healing zone, which is really a worthwhile journey to start and to continue. That's basically what I try to do with my blog.
Yeah, I think that that's pretty awesome. And I know Claudia probably thinks the same.
I absolutely do. And I have to say, Walter, it's been a real pleasure being on the show with you and definitely following you in social media as much as possible.
Thanks a lot. It was really a pleasure for me too. It was a really nice conversation. Thanks so much to both of you.
Oh, absolutely. And to be quite honest with you, I wouldn't mind having you back multiple times.
I'm happy to whenever you want.
Yeah, I think that would be excellent.
I went over the excessive shame of talking in this kind of setting a long time back. So that's a problem I don't have anymore. So we can talk whenever you feel like.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So definitely, this is Walter Vartenweiler, and I got to tell you, it was a true pleasure to have him with us to give us the different aspects from a culture aspect, to give us different aspects from what it is that people go through. But Claudia, it's really all about using our mindset to be our very best ally, and Walter really goes out of his way to do that.
He sure does. Been great. Yes, looking forward to having you back, Walter. So thank you.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
So for now, folks, we're going to say thank you for listening, and we want you to use your mindset to be your very best ally. But for now, have a good day, and we'll talk to you again soon, Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Happy healing. Bye.